And to add to Julie's remarks about the people standing in the back of the room, we have had in prior years awardees who weren't in the room when their awards were announced and presented. So at least you could be a recipient of an award from one of the sponsoring organizations. So grab your seats. That said, I'd like to introduce the head table to you. And normally we would be able to say a man's name first and the wife's name second, but in this case, I'm going to reverse it. So I'll begin at my extreme left to introduce Juliana Maley, who is the wife of Don Maley, Ambassador of the United States to the UN. Then Terry Barton, wife of Joe Barton, who has been in Congress since the early 80s, and I even remember that time. And then Alan, you've seen earlier today, but now swinging again, continuing from left to right, John Fund, who is a columnist, pundit, commentator, extraordinaire on a variety of issues and a variety of publications. And following John is Emily Miller, whom you'll be hearing from this afternoon from the Washington Times, framed for her Emily Gets Your Gun series. And then Bobby Ross, who is a pioneer at the American Civil Liberties Union in forming a Second Amendment committee, American Bar Association. They don't give me any notes or any script, so I have to wing it. They figure I've been around here that long, I'll get it right. And finally, someone who has been at various GRPCs in the past, whose material you have read either in book form or in his many columns that have been published in a variety of papers, whose research has been groundbreaking and continues to support the Second Amendment movement, John Lott. I guess we keep switching hats so often, we miss our bet every once in a while. At this point, we begin with our two featured speakers. We're lucky this afternoon. Some of the other people on the podium head table will be speaking to you in separate sessions this afternoon. But at this time, we are privileged to have a representative from the 6th District of Texas who has been a friend of the Second Amendment movement and a pioneer in the Energy Committee, and currently, I think, is Chairman Emeritus of the House Energy Committee. So I'd like to invite Joe Barton to come up to the mic and give him a good welcome. Thanks.
Well, thank you. I am really, really honored to be here. You know, being a member of Congress, you're not really liked that much. I guess y'all know that. We did an opinion poll not too many months ago, and the approval rating of the Congress was below 10%. Organized crime and prostitution have higher favorability ratings. Yeah, somebody always says that, and you know, there are some differences. Organized crime is organized. Prostitution makes a profit. There are some differences, but I know I'm not a household word in any of your districts. I'm hardly not even a household word in my household. I have a 7-year-old son. I'm here with my wife, Terry, and we have a 7-year-old son, and he loves to ride in parades with me. And we were riding in the Ennis Polka Fest parade last May, and I think I was the grand marshal or the grand sponsor or something. But we're in this car, and, you know, as we're going down the parade route, you know, I'm waving to people, and Jack's waving to people, and everybody's saying, "Hey, Jack, hey, Jack." And then I heard, you know, who's that with him? And I said, "Well, that's his dad." Of course, he started the first grade this year, and he goes to public school, Stephen F. Austin Elementary in Ennis, Texas, a little small town. And the ultimate insult was I took him to school one day and walked him in, and I actually went to lunch with Terry and I. We went to have lunch with him, and the little kids line up, you know, and they walk into the lunchroom, and I heard the little kid said, "Who's that with Jack?" "Oh, that's his grandfather. That's his grandfather. I'm his dad, and I'm proud of it." You know, you can tell a Texan, but you can't tell us much. And We are very pro-freedom in Texas, and we're very pro-gun in Texas. How many Texans are here in the room besides me? But those of you that are non-Texan, we're going to do a little quiz here about where you can carry a gun in Texas. You know, can you carry a gun in Texas legally into church? Yes, you can. Can you carry a gun into a bar, and that's not a legal bar, that's a bar where you drink alcohol? No. You can carry one to church, but you can't carry it in the bar. If you went to watch a football game at Cowboy Stadium, could you legally carry a gun into the stadium? Actually, yes, you can. But if you went to the racetrack, Lone Star Park, the racetrack, could you carry a gun into the racetrack? No, you can't. Texas, the right to keep and own a gun. The U.S. Constitution, the Second Amendment, gives us the right to keep and bear arms. In Texas, it's also in the state constitution. So we're kind of belt and suspendered in Texas. You know, we have it in the U.S. Constitution. We also have it in the state constitution. And, you know, most of what Texans say is 100% true, or at least close enough for government work, as we say in Washington. But anecdotally, not too many years ago, there was a governor of some eastern state, and he was out doing something, and a coyote ran across his path, and he got all upset, and he formed a committee and a special report and investigation on, you know, what kind of a coyote and what to do about it. Well, in Texas, our governor, Governor Rick Perry, was out jogging. He saw a coyote. He just pulled out his pistol and shot it. And the media heard about it and said, "We hear you got a coyote problem in Texas." And the governor said, "What coyote?" So, I mean, you know, there is a difference. I've got my wife here with me, Terry, and she loves guns. In fact, she was hoping y'all might have a gun show here. She was telling me that she was thinking about buying a gun. You know, there's good news and bad news in that. Obviously, we want her to protect herself and my little boy when I'm not around. But a name you may have heard of is Dick Armey. Have y'all heard of Dick Armey? Dick and I got elected the same year in 1984. And we did a lot of campaigning together, and so I got to where I could tell his stories and he could tell my story. But the gun issue was an issue in the campaign in 1984. And Dick's wife's name is Susan Armey. And so we were... the gun issue came up at one of our debates, and Army was asked his position on gun control, and he said, "Well, here's my wife's position on it. You know, she said, according to Dick Army, if I ever catch you, Dick Army, with another woman, the first word you're going to hear is, 'How many bullets in this gun?' And the last word you're going to hear is, 'How do you reload it?'" So, I mean, that's kind of where we are in Texas. You don't think that?
I've never said that.
Well, good. Having a little husband-wife dialogue here. That's not all bad. But, you know, we obviously, we got the Wall Street Journal here, or at least it used to be with the Wall Street Journal. Still is a contributor. So I'm going to say something, and I know that it'll stay in this room. You know, my family, my grandfather and my father did their very best to teach me how to shoot when I was a little boy and a teenager. And I am not a good shot, but they did their best. But my father and my grandfather were big believers in gun control. They really believed in gun control. They both told me, you know, if you aim at it, hit it. You know? And if you anything you aim at, be willing to pull the trigger. So they were strong believers in gun control. And, you know, don't aim the gun if you're not going to use it, but if you aim it, be able to hit whatever your target is. And I guess that's, to kind of cut to the chase, that's kind of where we are today in the political debate on gun rights and gun owners, and I have to say how proud I am that you folks are here. I didn't realize how big an organization you had. I was asked talking to Alan last night, who founded this organization way back in, did you say 1974? And I said, well, how many members do you have? And I thought, 50,000, 100,000. You got 650,000 members. That's amazing. Yeah. 600. I'm real big, obviously, in the Republican Party, at least in Texas, or at least in Ennis, or at least in my house. And the Texas Federation of Republican Women, which is the largest Republican women's group in the country, has less than 20,000 members. And I think the National Federation of Republican Women has right at 100,000. So 650,000 is a big deal. It's a real big deal. And I know that you're not directly affiliated with the National Rifle Association. And politically, I've been very involved with the NRA. In fact, I went and had my staff look at my voter ratings with the NRA since I got elected. And most years I'm an A, and some years I'm an A+. Now, I don't know the difference between an A and A+, but as far as I can tell, whatever the key scores are, key ratings are, my lifetime rating is A+, and as close to 100% as Congress can be. So, you know. But that's you know, the truth is, and now I'll try to be a little bit more serious, a little more substantive. The truth is that the House of Representatives, as a group, there are 435 of us in the House, and right now, I think there are 242 Republicans, and the balance is Democrat, about 188 or something like that, maybe 190. But we're pro Second Amendment. In fact, while there are a lot of anti-gun bills filed, not any of those have gotten any hearings. And the only way you get an anti-gun amendment on the floor is because our leadership in the House has an open process on appropriation bills. And you can have closed rules, open rules, and modified open rules. But a closed rule would be if you brought a bill to the floor, you couldn't offer any amendments. And a modified open rule is you could offer an amendment if you reported it to the Rules Committee and they made it in order. Well, an open rule is anybody who has an amendment that's germane can offer it. And obviously openness is better than being closed. And so under Speaker Pelosi, when the Democrats controlled the House, most of the rules were closed rules. So Republicans didn't get to offer lots of amendments. But under the Republican leadership, under Speaker Boehner, our appropriation bills are all open rules. So you will see anti-gun amendments made come to the floor on the appropriation bills because we have an open rules process. And that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. But you won't see any of them accepted. You know, in the House, we are a pro-gun rights House. Almost all the Republicans are for the right to keep and bear arms, and a substantial number of Democrats, not a majority. I'm not going to say that. But people like John Dingell of Michigan, who's a senior member of the House of Representatives. He has served, I think, 52 years, which is just amazing. But he's a big hunter and fisherman, very, very strong proponent of the Second Amendment. So the Senate's a different ball game, and I don't think y'all going to have any members of the Senate here. It's probably for the best, you know. You know, I can. Again, they'll keep this in the room, but I'm not a big fan of the Senate. They're designed to do nothing. I mean, they really are. You guys get mad at the House, and justifiably so. I understand that. But in the House of Representatives, you know, a majority is going to move things. It may not go anywhere in the Senate, and the president may veto it, But if you have a majority in the House, you'll move bills. Mr. Fund will tell you that. Regardless of which party controls the House, things happen in the House, which is as it should be. And then they go to the Senate, and you never hear from them. You know, I mean, the Senate can't agree that the sun comes up in the east. You know, and it's just, the Senate's tough. That's all I'm going to say. So I can't speak for the Senate, but in the House, very pro-gun. Now, let's talk a little bit about the Second Amendment. And I have my little pocket constitution here. And which was printed by the House of Representatives, actually, which is a good thing. And First Amendment, who can tell me what the First Amendment is? Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, right to petition, redress of Congress. You know, that's paramount in a democracy. So I don't think the First Amendment is by accident. You know, it's the ability of the people to say what they want, to hold their government accountable, and to have a press that can tell the truth as they know it. You caught that. You got a quick group here. All right, the Second Amendment, which is the whole point of this meeting, is a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That's pretty straightforward. Pretty straightforward. Now, I was asked, doing a little ground research last night at the reception, and I asked, where she is, his wife, Julianne, who is an amazing woman in every way possible, and if she's here, she is a wealth of historical information about the organization and about the issue. But I asked her, I said, is there anywhere else in the world before we adopted the Second Amendment to the Constitution where it was in writing that the people had the right to keep and bear arms? And I thought the answer was no. I kind of thought we were the first, and so I was going to brag on that. And she said, oh, no, it's not true. She said Magna Carta in Great Britain gave the right of the people to keep and bear arms. And I said, I thought that was just for the nobles, just for the nobility. She said, no, there were some paragraphs in there about the people to keep and bear arms. And then later on, as the parliamentary system evolved in Great Britain, they passed some laws that were in writing the right of the people to have of arms. So the United States Constitution wasn't the first place. But it was, Alan says it was the last place. Sad but true. But it, at the time, I mean, this is why I'm not a constitutional scholar, and I'm not a gun expert. It would be a bad policy for me to put myself forward to this group as I'm some sort of an expert on the history of gun rights. My family has always owned guns, and I'm a big proponent of the right to keep and bear arms, but I am not an expert. But when we put this in the Constitution back in the 1700s, it was a big deal. It was a very big deal. And it wasn't serendipity, as far as I'm concerned, that it was the Second Amendment. The First Amendment was the basic freedom of the people. The Second Amendment is the basic amendment to guarantee, in my opinion, the First Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms. Yeah. And just to put it in historical context, today, if we were holding this meeting that's right going on right now here at the Hyatt in Orlando, Florida, this meeting were held almost anywhere else in the world, but certainly in a lot of places in the world, it would probably be illegal. And you could probably be arrested. You would certainly be surveilled. Who are those people? Are they subversives? Are they fomenting a revolution? That's not what you're here for. You're here to protect the basic right of the Constitution, and you're doing it in a legal way. If we went to great, if we hopped on a plane here at the airport, and by the way, I was real worried about how to get from the airport to the hotel. You know, usually I, being a congressman, somebody picks me up and we have directions and people, you know, I'm asking my wife, how close are we to the hotel? We're still at the gate almost. And she said, we're here. We're at the hotel. So, but if we hopped on a plane and went over to London and got off the plane and we, certainly as a U.S. citizen, we couldn't buy a gun. And if we were a British citizen, it would be very, very difficult today in Great Britain. Not impossible, but very difficult. But here in the United States, it's still not only possible, it is relatively easy. Now, my liberal friends in Congress would tell you that that's a bad thing, that it should be much more difficult. And I, you know, I understand there are certain elements of society that we have every right, and I support the right to restrict ownership or possession of those kinds of people. If they have a mental disability or a criminal record or they've used a weapon in the commission of a crime, I mean, even in Texas, we have very strict laws on what you can't do with weapons, what you can't do with guns. And we enforce those laws. We enforce them, as we should. But for well over the huge majority of the population that keeps and bear arms, you never abuse it, you never misuse it, you never use it in the commission of a crime. In fact, in preparation for this speech, I had my staff call down to Austin. You know, we have a concealed handgun law now, and you can take a class and you can get licensed to carry a concealed handgun. And some of my best friends conduct those classes. In fact, I've had made it available to everybody on my congressional staff in Texas to take one of those classes if they wanted to, so they could get their license. And I'd say about half my staff has taken advantage of that. And we've actually had advisory committee hearings, or not hearings, meetings in my district on telling people how to go about doing that. But anyway, I had my staff call down to Austin and say, what are the statistics on people misusing that law? Do we have a record in Texas that people who had the right to carry a concealed handgun, they've committed a crime or they've somehow abused the right that they got for doing that? And the answer I got back was that they couldn't find a record. Now, that doesn't mean there's not. It's possible that we called the wrong office and you know, it was Friday and maybe they were out to late lunch or, you know, something like that. But, you know, there's certainly not a huge number. I think that's a fair statement. There's not a huge number of people that have taken advantage of the state law and got a right to carry a concealed handgun and have somehow misused it. And again, the point is, people understand that we have a right under the Second Amendment of the Constitution, but with that right comes responsibility. And that responsibility for the overwhelming number of people that use the right, take advantage of it, they honor it. It's not abused in any way. Last thing I want to say, and then I'll turn it back over because I know you've got several other speakers. We have an Attorney General of the United States that I voted to hold in contempt of Congress. And we have a little constitutional problem, though, when we hold somebody in contempt of Congress, which in the time I've been in the Congress, and I've been there 28 years, I think this is the second time. I mean, it's not something you do every day. It's a big deal to be held in contempt of Congress. The law and the constitutional enforcement is at the Justice Department, and the person responsible for enforcing contempt of Congress is the Attorney General. So when we held the Attorney General in contempt of Congress, and we send the necessary paperwork over to the Justice Department, and they put it on the Attorney General's desk, and he opens the letter. Aha! I've been held in contempt of Congress. I have to enforce this against myself. I don't think so. So there's a little glitch in the system there that we need to fix. But Eric Holder was not held in contempt of Congress because he's a Democrat appointee of President Obama. He was held in contempt of Congress because this fast and furious, the entire concept should turn your stomach. To knowingly let guns go into the hands of, I don't know how to put this in a polite way, in the hands of people that you know are going to misuse them, that you know are engaged in illegal activities, that you know are violating all kinds of state and federal laws, that in itself is inexcusable. And then to compound the problem, to act like you don't know anything about it, and basically, to use a Texas term, lie to the Congress about it. You know? I don't understand that. I don't understand that. And I will tell you, as a senior member of the House, I am not persuaded because the Inspector General at the Justice Department has conducted an internal investigation and said, well, based on what the Inspector General knows, you know, it's not something that we need to pursue. It was wrong to begin in the beginning. It was wrong the way the Attorney General handled the interplay between the Congress. And again, to go back to what I said at the beginning, I know that there's not a high approval rating of the Congress of the United States. You know, Mark Twain in the 1890s said the U.S. Congress is the only purely criminal class in America. So, I mean, it's good sport to make fun of the Congress. It always has been, and it probably always should be, because we are of the people, and the bar to get elected to Congress is lower than the bar to get selected to work at McDonald's. You don't have to have an academic ranking. You don't have to have an educational background or even a work background. You got three things you got to do if you want to be a congressman, and they're not real difficult. You got to live to be the ripe old age of 25. Most of us in this room qualify on that, I think. You got to be a citizen of the United States, and I bet most people in this room qualify on that. And you got to live in the state that you're running from. That is it. And the bar was set that way for a purpose, because the House is supposed to reflect the people. So I know that it's just good American fun to make fun of the Congress. And we're never going to have a real high approval rating. I know that. I understand that. But having said that, when the Attorney General of the United States does not comply with a subpoena issued by the House of Representatives to provide basic information, that is not only an affront to the Congress, it is an affront to you. It is an affront to you. Because we reflect the will of the people, even when we disagree. When John Dingell, Democrat of Michigan, and Joe Barton, Republican of Texas, both past chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, currently both chairman emeritus of the Energy and Commerce, when we have a disagreement, it's about policy. It's not about process. And to put my former chairman's hat on, I'll tell you one story that is 100% true. And this happened in the Bush administration. We were doing an investigation of child pornography on the Energy and Commerce Committee. And the FBI had established a task force to work on child pornography, which is a terrible thing. Child pornography is a terrible thing. And so in the course of our investigation, we identified several agents in the FBI that were the lead players. So we called over to the FBI at staff level, said, we'd like for these agents to testify before the committee. And the answer was, our agents don't testify before Congress. And so I checked with Mr. Dingell, who was a senior Democrat on the committee, and said, will you back me up? And he said, yes, we have the right to this information. So we elevated it. And I called over to speak to the FBI director. They were initially told that the FBI director wouldn't take my call. FBI directors don't take calls from members of Congress, apparently. So we called back over, and I made this call myself, not my staff, not my secretary. And I said, I would like to speak to the director of the FBI, and I want to do it as soon as possible. And I started to get the runaround. He's on travel. Our next call is going to be the President of the United States, George Bush, who's my personal friend. He will take my call. Now, you can have the president call, or he can take my call. So about 15 minutes later, I get a call from the director of the FBI. And I can tell that he's not happy. And the director of the FBI is a good man. But he wasn't happy that he had to talk to me. And I told him what we wanted. And he said, well, our agents don't testify before Congress. I said, well, it's awful funny because your agent that doesn't testify before Congress just did a live interview on CNN or Fox News with his real name. And I said, if he can go on live television, he can come before Congress. And he said, well, he's not going to. And I said, well, this was about 3 o'clock. I said, well, you got till 5 o'clock. And if I don't hear that he's going to testify, he and you are going to be subpoenaed. And he said, you wouldn't subpoena the director of the FBI, would you? And I said, well, why don't you call President Bush and ask him if Joe Barton won't subpoena your butt? Now, I didn't say butt. I just elaborated on that. I was professional in my, but I said, yes, sir, I will. And so about 4:45, he called me back and he said, our guys will be there. And he couldn't have been more happy, smiley faced, you know, just what can I do? And I said, well, Mr. Director, an hour or so ago, you were pretty upset about this. What changed your mind? And he said, I talked to President Bush. So I tell that story, which almost all that's true that I just said. But I tell that story because it is the power of the people. It is not the power of Joe Barton or even the power of the chairman of the Energy and Commerce. It's the power of the people to have the information. And that's where I think Eric Holder and President Obama perhaps have dropped the ball. They think they're more important, apparently, or they think they know more. And you're seeing that right now in this thing about Libya. You know, when they started out that it was a spontaneous uprising. It wasn't. In any event, Second Amendment is there for a reason. You're part of the process to keep that in the Constitution. And all I can say is God bless you and keep up the good work. And thanks for letting my wife and I.
I might just explain to the congressman the difference between an A and an A+. When he got an A+, his opponent was an A. And in Texas, that probably happens an awful lot. Now it's my pleasure to introduce someone who has had many careers. 28 years in the U.S. Army, many years in the State Department, particularly working on a variety of international disarmament issues, probably everything from chemical weapons to nukes. And in 2008, after many years with the department, he retired. More recently, however, there's apparently times in Washington where wisdom prevails, and more recently he was asked to come back and to represent the United States at the Arms Trade Treaty negotiations. So, at this point, it's my pleasure to introduce Ambassador Donald Maley, who can tell you the real facts about the ATT. Thank you.
There are times when they say there's no fool like an old fool, which is probably why I agreed to come back after retiring and do the Arms Trade Treaty. And as indicated by my short biography, and by what some of you who may know me know about my background. In terms of civilian activities, when I wasn't in the United States Army, and frankly, even some of the times when I was still in the United States Army, I'm a negotiator by trade, and so in contrast to some of the things we've heard about today in other vignettes, I always like to try to get things done without violence if that's possible, but that's not always possible. But I did want to leave you at the outset with one point about negotiating. Negotiating is a fine thing, and it's, I believe, a thing you always ought to try to do if it's possible to do it under controlled circumstances. But I have a rule in terms of negotiating, and one of the great advantages of being as old as I am and as retired as I am, so that you're doing it on an on-call basis and they want you as opposed to you want them, I want to make sure that every time I go into a negotiation that everybody up my tape of command in the United States government understands that I do not believe in entering a negotiation in which no outcome is not an acceptable outcome, because you've always got to be able to walk away from the deal if it's not the right deal, and if you can't walk away, then you're going to get a bad deal. Now, I'd also like to make one nuance of change. Earlier, I was referred to as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, and that's not true. The United States Ambassador to the United Nations is Susan Rice. I am just a little old non-proliferation guy who carries the rank of ambassador. We make a lot of those in the Department of State. And what it does is that helps with a lot of Europeans, because you could be called the Honorable and things like that, and Your Excellency and all this sort of thing. And they seem to think that what you say means more if you have that rank and back in front of your name as opposed to if you don't. It doesn't make any difference, but sometimes they think that. But in any event, I'm really a non-proliferation guy. And looking at the Arms Trade Treaty, frankly, I was one of the people in the United States government that helped change the United States government position from just saying, oh, no, we're not going to do this at all, to trying to do it. And I did that for a couple of reasons. First of all, if we could get it right, now, I don't have any guarantees we're going to get it right, and we certainly haven't gotten it right yet, but if we get it right, the United States, as a government and as a country, spends a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of energy on both non-proliferation and counter-proliferation, in which we try to keep established bad guys from having more capability to do bad things. And I talk about that in terms of the Assad regime in Syria. I talk about that in terms of warlords in sub-Saharan Africa that decide they want to try to slaughter all the women and children within a 50-mile radius. I talk about that in terms of a number of things. And we spend a whole lot of money and a whole lot of effort, and we actually put some pretty good guys at risk of their lives and other things in trying to get information about how these illicit clandestine activities are taking place, and then go on bended knee to some not necessarily very reliable countries and ask them if they please, please, please wouldn't try to do something about either brokers or merchants or people in their country that are actually promulgating and initiating these kinds of activities, and try to keep these things from happening. Now, sometimes we get good results. One of the things I did in an earlier incarnation was go into Libya to take out the weapons of mass destruction in Libya in 2004. And frankly, that came about, and Gaddafi's decision on that came about, for the very simple reason that he was trying to get nuclear weapons, and he'd spent a whole lot of Libyan money in getting 5,000 centrifuges that were good enough that they could actually cause him to enrich uranium. And we figured that out, and we intercepted the boat and took all 5,000 centrifuges off it, because it was an illicit transaction from the Khan network out of Pakistan. Now, that caused him to scratch his head and say, you know, this isn't working. And so, therefore, he decided that maybe the thing he ought to do is get rid of that. But that cost the United States a whole lot of effort to get that done. And frankly, we made two attempts to get that ship intercepted before we finally got it intercepted, and that was only because they happened to go into the coastal waters of Italy after they'd gone off of a couple of other countries that wouldn't cooperate with us. So the idea here, folks, is that if you could get an arms trade treaty that required the other 170 countries that don't have effective export control mechanisms in place in their national administrations for the international trade of those kinds of weapons so that we could therefore have a legal basis to require their governments to cooperate with us or subject themselves to sanctions for not cooperating with us in terms of trying to stop these things, that would be a cost-effective move for the United States. And that's the value that we seek out of this negotiation. Now, one of the troubles with the negotiation, and I think Alan Youngman very succinctly and correctly to you earlier this morning characterized a part of it, is that that doesn't constitute all the 193 countries in the United Nations General Assembly that are part of this negotiation. And believe me, one of the habits that you have to get used to in that is that every country, even if they've got a gross domestic product of $142, and they've got a population of 50,000, and about two people speak anything over four letter words, believe that they have an equal vote to the United States in this kind of thing, and so therefore you have a little bit of a difficulty trying to get, you know, who's important and who really means something sorted out from who doesn't. But one of the problems, frankly, is that there are simultaneous negotiations going on the arms trade treaty at the same time in the same room that each side thinks is the negotiation that's important. And in the United States case, we're not really quite so sure. One of them is indeed a debate among advanced countries, and mostly this is the Europeans and some of the other Asian countries that are responsible, about trying to establish some export control requirements. But the second negotiation that's going on in there is a small arms negotiation. Now, there are a lot of activities that go on in the United Nations, some of which are good, some of which aren't. Some of which are useful, some of which aren't. And one of the things that's gone on for a long time is there's a thing called a program of action on small arms and light weapons that goes on in the United Nations on an annual basis. And they've been trying to do things about small arms and light weapons and ammunition for 10 years, and they've never been able to reach a consensus on doing so, which is not necessarily bad, given some of the proposals that they've had to consider. Now, that's the debate, however, that a number of countries are trying to insert by the back door into the arms trade treaty to try to get done things in the arms trade treaty negotiation as a legally binding requirement that they couldn't get done in the program of action or that they couldn't get done in a straightforward fashion. And that is a problem that we are going to have to continue to be vigilant about. Because what that's trying to do, in my judgment, quite candidly, is that's trying to find an international treaty which is going to impose on the United States and on other responsible countries in the world a responsibility which is not theirs. It is a responsibility to substitute for failed governments in trying to impose local law enforcement requirements which they have neither the structure nor the stature to try to enforce for themselves, and then to hold us responsible for their failures of basic government. And that's something that we will not and cannot permit. Now, this is a Second Amendment meeting, and the Second Amendment certainly is one of the things which gets a lot of attention within the context of the Arms Trade Treaty. I want to tell you, from a negotiator's standpoint, and from the standpoint of the head of the United States delegation to this negotiation, that's actually one of the easiest things that I have in my portfolio, because there is no question about it in either the United States policy process. I don't have interagency debates in Washington or in the delegation room in New York back in the U.S. mission, where people are saying, wait a minute, we can go ahead and agree to this kind of a provision even though it puts the Second Amendment at risk. Nobody from any agency says that. One thing, we know better. For second thing, we keep getting letters from senators that say, if you don't know better, we do. And one of the things that I tell other countries that happens to be true, but is also something that makes it very easy, is there has been, for example, a good deal of international commentary to me around the corners of this negotiation that says, well, you know, we understand that the United States is in a political campaign right now, and maybe the president doesn't have enough flexibility to do some of these things because he's busy running for re-election. But, you know, the election's going to be over in November, and so therefore you guys will be able to do a lot more things after November than you could do before November. And, you know, one of these things, for example, is you might be able to soften some of these conditions. The answer is you people don't understand something. What you don't understand is that the United States Constitution is not a partisan political issue with the United States. It is a fundamental part of the United States. And frankly, I don't care who wins the election in November. And I don't even care what the very careful count in terms of the balance of parties in the Senate is. If it's a violation of the United States Constitution, and a violation most especially of the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution, no United States Senate is going to come within 25 votes of ratifying that treaty, so it doesn't really matter. That's not a political question. One of the other things that Alan mentioned this morning, for example, is the issue about amendments in the current draft that we've got floating around out in the United Nations. And indeed, there are countries that are trying to push to have a 51% majority vote on that draft in the United Nations General Assembly later this year. Now, right now, I can tell you that my own information and my own gut feeling, as well as my own consultations, indicate that that is going to fail, and that we are indeed going to move to a subsequent conference in 2013, which then may lead to a, may lead to a subsequent conference in 2014 or whatever the case may be. But in any event, there is still going to be an opportunity to try to rectify the count in some of the issues that are obviously badly done in this current draft that we have floating around in the world. Now, always I want to point out that when we have that kind of a negotiating status, there's also the case that you may retrograde. And I'm sure that Joe can tell you that happens in the Congress too. When you don't have a final bill that's passed, there's always a sense that somebody's going to introduce another amendment at the last minute that's going to actually weaken the bill or go backwards from where you are. That's something we have to look out for in any subsequent conferences in the United Nations. Somebody's going to try to reopen issues that we threw out the last time. But the amendment process, as it is currently drafted in Article 20 of the draft document that's there, is a very interesting one, and it's unprecedented in the nature of international treaties. And I'm going to take the time to tell you about it because it's an example of the kinds of things that people work out. Now, Alan told you about the Mexican effort to try to put or instead of and in terms of the issue about having change of title or possession. That's a very subtle and actually very advanced maneuver because somebody might miss the or as opposed to the and in terms of doing that and think, well, this is basically what we said before. That's why, you know, words do make a significant difference and you have to make sure you don't get caught at it. Well, the original thought in the amendment process in this was you had a bunch of countries that were trying to say that once you had the treaty, that if you called an amendment conference, you ought to be able to have the treaty amended by a 51% vote of the states' parties to the treaty, that is, those countries that had joined the treaty. Now, wait, just a minute here, folks. We have consensus decision-making that adopted the treaty to begin with. So what you're trying to tell me is what you want is you want all those things that you couldn't get consensus on in the negotiation of the actual treaty now introduced where you only have to get 51% to adopt them afterwards. No, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way at all. So we finally managed to convince people that this was a non-starter, and so they took that language out and said that if you have an amendment conference, you have to get consensus among the states' parties in order to adopt an amendment. Now, I apologize because this is going to go into inside baseball and a little bit of detail in terms of how international law works, but once an amendment to a treaty that you are a party to has passed, that amendment is not binding on you as a state party until you have also ratified the amendment. It's one of the reasons why you don't get treaties amended very often, because that would have two tiers of responsibilities for the countries that are party to it. But the problem is that the way the language is written right now, you pass the amendment by consensus of all those states' parties at the amendment conference. Okay, fine. And then when 51% of the states' parties have ratified the amendment becomes binding on all states' parties. Wait just a minute here. What that means is that if the United States doesn't like the amendment, but 51% of the rest of the states' parties do, it's now binding on the United States. We've been looking at the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States so far, but there's another part of that in the actual Constitution itself, which says it's the responsibility of the United States Senate to give advice and consent to the executive branch of the government on any obligation that we have in an international agreement, and that's a two-thirds majority required to do that. And again, what I am able to tell people, and it's very good to be able to tell them this, is that if you think there's ever in the rest of civilization going to be a United States Senate in which 67 of those senators are going to surrender that constitutional prerogative of the United States Senate so that they could let the country be bound by obligations on which they had had no vote. One other time, I don't care if they're Tea Party members, I don't care if they're Libertarian Party members, I don't care if they're Democrats, I don't care if we get a Liberal Party established, I don't care if they're Republicans, I don't care who they are. No group of United States senators is going to surrender that constitutional right. And so that's one in which we don't have a worry. Now, those are some of the things that we're doing with it, and that's sort of the inside story in terms of some of the things going on with the treaty. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Ambassador. And the inside baseball is really good for most of our audience who hasn't had to spend time at the UN like some of us have in the past couple of years on this. And let me tell you, it is not a whole lot of fun. We're running a little behind, obviously, but it was really worth running behind so far today because of the information given out. So I'm going to move directly to my favorite part of the luncheon agenda or the whole conference is the awards ceremony. I'm going to have to rush it a little bit, so I apologize in that because I want to really do justice to all those people that really deserve these awards. And so let me just start real quickly on this. The first award we're giving out is the Grassroots Organization of the Year. And this is a Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms Award. And this year it goes to the Cal Guns Foundation in California. So somebody from Cal Guns, please come up here real quickly. And again, in saving time, on most of these I'm going to not read the inscriptions on the plaques. I think a lot of you understand what kind of work these grassroots groups do. The people don't get paid for what they do. It's all volunteer and they really deserve it. The second one is one to me that's very, very special because I've gotten to know this gentleman over the last number of years now. And, you know, it's one thing to be a grassroots activist. This is the Grassroots Activist of the Year Award. But this is a really special one because it actually is going to somebody who spends a lot of his time in his state capital doing a significant amount of lobbying work to the point where not only is he on a first-name basis with all the legislators and all the staff members, but he's probably on a first-name basis with the elevator operators. And this one goes to Jose Barreras from Puerto Rico. I hope Jose is in the room. While he's coming up here, I've spent a number of occasions with him in the state capitol lobbying by his side. And his organizational skills and his work with members of all political parties in Puerto Rico is absolutely phenomenal in changing Puerto Rico's gun laws and moving them into the post-Heller McDonald period. Thanks. Normally when we have more time, I let everybody talk a little bit about themselves, but we really don't have the time to do that, so I apologize. The next one I'd like to give out is to the Scholar of the Year. It's really important for the gun rights movement to be able to have the ammunition intellectually to be able to fight this battle, not only on today's playing fields, but in future playing fields. And this year's award goes to Professor Gary Mauser, who unfortunately can't be here. He's a professor emeritus from Simon Fraser University, but I hope somebody from the Canadian Firearms Association on his behalf will come up and pick up his award. He is a U.S. citizen. He just teaches school in Canada. Somebody here from the Canadian Firearms Association? And if not, we'll get it to him later. Next one goes to, is it also a Citizens Committee Award? I'm sorry, this is a SAF Award, and this one goes to the Journalist of the Year. And we always like to reward people who are journalists who take Second Amendment as seriously as the First Amendment. And this one, it's really my honor and privilege to give to Emily Miller from the Washington Times. Emily? Her columns and blogs have reached all of America, not just Washington, D.C. And as the applause from the audience here, everybody sort of knows and probably read her material. And she's done yeoman's work for us. And thank you, Emily. Okay. Now I go to the Affiliate of the Year Award. This is an award from the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms to one of its state affiliates. And of course, this is embarrassing again, because I forget how many years in a row the same state affiliate keeps getting it. But until another state affiliate is willing to step up and do as good a job, the Illinois State Rifle Association gets it again. Don Moran, the president, thank you. It really, I just have to say, add on to that, it really is embarrassing, because we sit down and we decide who's going to get these awards. When some group stands out so above everybody else, it's really hard not to keep giving the same award, but it does get a little embarrassing when you can't recognize somebody else. So everybody out there, got to work harder next year. One of our bigger awards we give out is the Gun Rights Defender of the Year. And this is a person who's actually done so much that he stands above as an activist above everybody else. Not necessarily it goes to an activist, sometimes it goes to an elected official as well. And this year's recipient of the Gun Rights Defender of the Year is Jim Irvine from the Buckeye Firearms Association in Ohio. Jim, I hope you're here. Next award goes to the Gun Rights Legislator of the Year. And unfortunately, he couldn't be here because of campaign season and being out there campaigning to help the Romney ticket get elected. But this year's recipient is Senator Jerry Moran, who's done yeoman's work this year in the Senate on gun rights legislation to help protect us against the United Nations assault on our gun rights. So we will make sure that our Washington, D.C. lobbyist gets this to Jerry Moran in his office. The next award we have is from the Citizens Committee. It's the Bill of Rights Award. And sometimes we give out awards that aren't directly related to guns directly themselves, but have to do in protecting gun rights at the same time as protecting our Bill of Rights. And this year's award goes to Doug Ritter from KnifeRights.org. Doug, are you in the room? Aha, he's not in the room. Well, I could just give it to somebody else, I guess. Let me scratch the name off. He's probably at his table, and that's why he's out there working the issue even to the last minute. The next award I'd like to give out is our Global Leadership Award, given out to somebody who's done the major work on the international level. And it's posthumous this year because Dr. Vito Genko is not with us anymore, who's done, as Julie mentioned, we said a moment of silence for him at the beginning of the conference. Gentleman has been with Beretta a number of years and in the World Forum for the Future of Sport Shooting Activities and a number of European groups as well. And Dr. Genko deserves this award more than anybody for all the years worth of work he has put in on global leadership. So he's unfortunately not here to accept it. Doug, come on up and get your Bill of Rights award. Wow. He deserves, I don't know anybody who works harder for the Bill of Rights than Doug. The next one is a Lifetime Achievement Award for working to defend the Second Amendment. And it's really easy to give this one out to Congressman Joe Barton. Congressman? Now there's a series of awards to give out, and I'm going to give them out rather quickly. So these are the Second Amendment Foundation Defender of Liberty Awards for people that have worked very hard on the issue during the calendar year and have done outstanding work. And to make life a little easier, I'm just going to call out all the names and have everybody come up at one time to help get us back on the agenda. Either that or my wife will disown me. I don't know if she made the joke this morning or not, but her nickname is the Time Nazi. Defender of Liberty Award winners, would you please come up? Dave Coppell, Robert Farrago, Freddie Rial, Alan Youngman, John Lott, Bobby Ross, Sean Carana, and Patrick Shomo. All these people have done an unbelievable amount of work defending our rights on grassroots level this year. And one more award to give out, but this one somebody else will present on all of our behalf. Thank you for being patient.
It is my extreme pleasure to give the Defender of the Constitution Award to Ambassador Maley. We are running behind, but I would like to tell you that this man has stood up on the floor of the UN temporary building, which will probably be there forever, and has managed, when they've dropped literally a bomb on us, on ammunition or something else, and managed within 5 minutes to synthesize the whole thing, stand up, and pretty much convince the whole room that he's right and everybody else was wrong. And we're not the only people who think that Ambassador Maley is a special person. So, Alan?
I'd like to read a letter that's addressed to Ambassador Maley. We want to thank you for your long and selfless service to our nation, both as an officer in the United States Army and as a diplomat in the United States Foreign Service. In both careers, your service has been marked by honor, integrity, courage, and an unfailing dedication to defending our nation and our way of life. Nowhere have these qualities been more clearly and dramatically displayed than in your representation of our country at the United Nations. Because of your leadership, the U.S. effort remains focused on attaining a treaty that can be effective in helping to combat the illicit global trade in military arms while fully protecting the rights of American citizens under the Second Amendment to our Constitution. Your diplomatic skill, strategic wisdom, reputation for candor, and the respect you have earned around the world have been critically important in guiding the process to date and ensuring that vital U.S. interests, to include the Second Amendment, have not been infringed. In recognition of your life, Don, if you come up here, please. In recognition of your lifetime of distinguished service to the American people, and as a token of our respect, admiration, and gratitude, we hope that you will accept this Colt 1911 government model pistol. I want you to know that this pistol was personally selected by another ferocious warrior, Lieutenant General, United States Marine Corps retired Bill Keyes, the president and CEO of Colt Firearms, personally selected this for you. It's a warrior's weapon, and we know that in your hands it will continue to exemplify the principle that guns in the right hands are an essential tool for the defense of individual liberty. Thank you for everything you've done.
Thank you.
That concludes our luncheon program. And we're almost back on time by a few minutes. If you want to take a break, I'll be back in the room at a quarter to two. And Alan pulls on my coat and says that if you didn't get a cover for your award, come back up, and we've got them still here. But in either case, Julie will begin the program promptly in 10 minutes.